thank you very much for that introduction. I'm quite excited to hear myself now. My wife is doing a workshop. John is doing a workshop tomorrow morning on building things that last, and some of it will involve some practical, tangible things that will carry on what I'm sharing with you tonight. There were two children from our world. Their names were Eustace Clarence Scrub and Jill Pohl. And they were being bullied by the other children at Experiment House. At Experiment House, children were allowed to do whatever they wanted to. Unfortunately, the bigger kids wanted to beat up the little kids. So Jill and Eustace go running off the playground and out into the field beside their school, trying to get away from the bullies. Eustace says to Jill, "You know, one time I was in, well, you won't believe this, but I was in another world. I have a feeling that perhaps this someone I met in this other world may be able to help us now." And so they join hands together, and Eustace told Jill, "On the count of three, we'll say together the name Aslan. Aslan. Aslan." Well, they did that, and nothing happened. So they continued to run, and they ran across this large field of heather. They went up to this old stone wall, which the kind they only have in England, and they went through this old gate, and as soon as they stepped to the other side, they discovered green grass. It looked like it was perfectly mowed, like the golf courses of Pebble Beach. They turned around and looked, and there was the old dead heather sitting on the hillside. They looked ahead, and they saw beautiful trees and a river flowing down, and they soon discovered that they walked into Aslan's own country. We are going to have to read C.S. Lewis's book, The Silver Chair, to find out what happens next. But I'm going to fast forward the story quickly to the point where the children are now about to accomplish their quest, which Aslan told them to do. They had to free the prince. It was the son of King Caspian, who they had met in the previous book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But this prince was captured by an evil witch, and he was tied to this silver chair. And in this silver chair, he did whatever the witch's bidding was. But 1 hour every day, he would come into his right mind. And when he was in his right mind, he would ask anyone who was about if they would let him out of the chair. "Please free me from all my captivity. Please let me go." But the witch had everyone convinced that when he was talking in his right mind, those were really the moments that he was insane. Don't listen to him. He'll try to talk you out of it. He'll try to get you to free him. And then, what mess will we be in then? Well, Eustace and Jill and another companion they picked up along the way named Puddleglum. Puddleglum is kind of part human, kind of part duck. He's from the species known as Marshwiggle in the land of Narnia. And Puddleglum was there with them. In this 1 hour when the prince's mind was clear, he said one thing that caught their attention. He said, "Please, please let me go. In the name of Aslan, let me go." Well, that was one of their clues. Free the one who says in the name of Aslan. So they unbound him, they destroyed the silver chair, and they were about to hightail it out of Underland, where the witch's lair was, to get back up to Overworld, where Narnia was. And just as soon as they were about to leave, who steps in but the Green Witch, playing her little mandolin, as she throws some green potion on the fire that was in the room, and a sweet savor fills the room, and she starts to play, "Thrum, thrum, thrum, pray tell me, children, thrum, where are you going?" "Well, we're leaving this place, we're going up to Overland, we're going back to Narnia." "Thrum, pray tell me, what is Narnia?" And the potion she had thrown on the fire was soon filling the room and filling their minds. And they had a much more difficult time thinking clearly. "Well, Narnia, well, it's up there." "Thrum, you mean in the pitch and mortar of the roof? Oh, silly children, you're just playing games." "Well, there's a sun up there," said one of the children. "Oh, a sun. Pray tell me, what is a sun?" "Thrum." And as the children thought, they thought, well, you see that lamp over there in the corner? Well, it's a lot like that lamp, only it's bigger, and, it doesn't hang from anything. It just hangs by itself in the sky." "Thrum, oh, silly children, don't you see you've just made a copy of my little lamp, made it very large? You're just playing child games." And the enchantment was growing thicker on their minds, and they could think less and less clearly. Then Jill thought of something that she knew she needed to say. And so just taking it from her gut, she just blurted out, "Well, there's Aslan. Oh, that's a good one, too. That's right. There's Aslan. That's right." Thrum, and the thrumming got a little faster. "Thrum, pray, tell me, who is this Aslan?" "Well, he's a lion, you see. Well, you've seen cats. Well, he's just like a large cat, only he's got a big hairy neck. It's called a mane, and oh, hang it all, don't you know what a lion is?" "Thrum, oh, silly children. Don't you realize you saw a cat in my world, and you made it very big, and you called it a lion, and you've given it a name? Oh, let us to sleep, and tomorrow will be a wiser day." And the enchantment grew in thicker, thicker, and thicker. And they discovered that the more thick the enchantment, the less you realize you're being enchanted at all. The title of my talk tonight is Cultural Illusions, or Enchantments, in the Christian School. It's one of those titles that, it's there to get your attention. Because, of course, in Christian education, we have no enchantments. That's why we're Christian. We know exactly what's going on in the culture, and we know the best way to fight it. Well, having been on the road these last several years, focusing specifically on youth and students, my wife and I have actually compiled over 2,000 questions from young people all over the country, from New Hampshire to California to the Midwest to Florida. Questions. And we ask students, we say, "You know, I want you to write down on the 3x5 card two questions that press on you most. The two questions such that if they were answered, life would be a little bit easier for you. Your two most pressing questions in life, such that if they were answered, life would be a little bit easier for you." And it's amazing what they write down. You would think they were written by 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. Some of the great questions of our time. How do we deal with the problem of pain? How do I deal with a God whom I can't feel, see, or can't sense his presence? And the questions come pouring in, and as you flip through them, as I was flipping through them to work on my book, tears come to the eyes. As you see, one girl wrote in extremely small print, "Why do I feel like I'm not worth anything?" And the handwriting illustrates it all. Anyone who's conscious knows that there is a culture clash we have these days. In fact, there's many cultures within the larger American culture. And some stand out more than others. Some have a greater voice than others. Some control the media more than others. But there's a lot of cultures, and they're all competing with their values. And we have decisions to make. The word culture actually has at the root of it the word cult. And when I say cult, don't think of like Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Science or other aberrations of Christianity. Just think of cult as a center of worship. Your cult is your religious center. We in this room hold to the Christian cult. And out of the Christian cult comes the Christian culture. In other words, out of our center of worship comes the values that we learn to live by. So when we're talking about culture or cultures, we're talking about all those small centers of worship. Some are larger than others that inform the kind of values we live with every day. These are the values that I'm speaking about that, and how they inform our students and our teachers and even ourselves as other cultures come in and maybe confuse us as to what the Christian culture is really all about. The dominant culture, the one that gets the most airtime in America, is the consumeristic, individualistic culture that's mixed with modernism and postmodernism. I'm not here to define what modernism and postmodernism is necessarily, but that's the kind, just think of consumerism and you have a good sense of what the culture is about. The culture of salesmanship. As Wendell Berry, the cultural critic, said, "If you wish to be among the beautiful, then you must buy the right fashions. They are no cheap fashions. And the right automobile, that's not cheap either. If you want to be counted as one of the intelligent, then you must shop for the right education. Not cheap, but also not difficult." There's a big connection these days between giving your money and actually being important in the culture itself. That's the way the cult of consumerism has informed us these days. And the cult of consumerism also gives us a lot of diversions. And we can pay for these diversions when we feel like life isn't very meaningful. Like there was a banner that hung over the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles. The Electronic Entertainment Expo is the largest annual conference convention where all the video game companies come together and they put on million-dollar displays to get you to buy their stuff. There was a banner hanging outside advertising Mountain Dew, and it said this: "Protecting your village from the dragon is way more important than your job." What does that have to do with Mountain Dew? But that's the consumer cult offering us another diversion. Life doesn't feel very meaningful. Like we heard this morning, you know, there's no matter how much money you make, there's more and more expensive diversions. And you find out that they really don't amount to a whole lot. And that happiness is found more in contentment, learning to know God. But the diversions are present for us everywhere. One of the biggest diversions available to our young people today is not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, it's the rock and roll part. The biggest diversion, I believe, for our young people today, the drug of our young people today, the thing where they find a certain sense of fulfillment, is in their music. I'm not talking about pagan music, secular music, music that's on the top 40 charts. I'm talking about music in general. Christian, pagan, whatever. Music in general. It's hard to find a young person today walking around without white earbuds sticking out of their ears. You pull up at the red light, you see them sitting in the back seat, not having conversations with their family, but plugged into the music, the songs they've heard already 100,000 times, but they need to hear it one more. Music really isn't there for them to inform them about how to think about life necessarily, even though there's some music that does that. I believe the music is there to tweak their emotional center, the same way you use crack cocaine to bring you back up to normal, or what you consider is normal. And you have to use it again and again to bring you back up to that normal functioning place. And talking about music to young people, oftentimes they'll say, well, what's wrong with using music to move your emotional center? Be like, that's just the thing. That's not what music was made for, although it will move your emotions. I find it also in the church. Music is used to tweak us, to make us think that worship is feeling a certain way. To be spiritual is to feel a certain way. And it's deeply deceptive. I was shocked when I found out there are actual conferences for worship leaders where they learn how to tweak the lights and the sound and the volume and a whole program just to move the emotions of the people into a spiritual experience. That's called manipulation. And nowhere in the New Testament do we find that that is called being spiritual. But that's something the culture has taught us. Use music to feed and change the emotion, because if you're not happy about the way life is going, just put on another MP3 song and maybe it'll help sort things out. And we've allowed you to put 5,000 songs in one MP3 player so that you can find the one you need the most quickly. And didn't somebody win an iPod tonight? Yeah. So beware, it'll get you. So talking about the cult, I'm talking about the center of worship that informs the value of a community. When I'm talking about the illusions or the enchantments, an enchantment, I'm referring to those things we find good and appropriate, which may not be good and appropriate at all. But that's the nature of an enchantment. We think something is good when it may not actually be good for us at all. Some enchantments I will not be talking about tonight, but I wanted to mention to you. An enchantment that is honest right now in education is thinking that the Middle Ages were actually the Dark Ages. There's a book out by Rodney Stark that was released just a few months ago called The Victory of Reason, in which he goes through the so-called Dark Ages and show how Christianity became the technological wonder of the world. How Christianity started what was called a university in the so-called Dark Ages. That's just a myth, the Dark Ages that floats around, rewritten history by 19th century anti-supernaturalists who hate Christianity, and it continues to propagate, the so-called Dark Ages Christians. Another myth that's in our culture is that we often put on the glasses of Immanuel Kant to read the ethics of the Bible, going more toward a duty ethic rather than a virtue ethic. Do the right thing simply by willing yourself to do it. That's Kant. Or the New Testament, which says, develop a well-organized heart, soul, mind, and strength, so that when you will to do the good, it's because you simply want to do the good, because you're becoming a good person. You don't just do good things. Another enchantment that's on our culture is that appearance and how you appear to people equals your value. And that is a deep one among our young people today, that your appearance determines your value. Like Nikki Reed said, who co-wrote the movie 13, which even though it's rated R, I highly, highly recommend it in thinking about teen culture. She says that in a middle school in Los Angeles, the biggest struggle young girls have is not any of the things their parents worry about. It's not about the sex. It's not about the drugs. It's what a girl thinks about her appearance. And when you look at a movie like that, you see how she wants to simply be approved or appear a certain way with her other girlfriends. And it leads to all sorts of drugs, stealing, sexual experimentation. And eventually she's so dissatisfied with herself, she starts cutting, which is another thing going on among our young people today. These diversions all about us because we think false beliefs about who and what we are. And these things, yes, are happening in the Christian schools. So the three illusions I want to talk to you about tonight. First of all, the death of truth, or the confusion about truth. The death of truth, or the confusion about truth. When Malcolm Muggeridge was talking to a man who once sat in the Kremlin when Russia was underneath atheistic communism. There was a man who was a young delegate, and he said there was something that was proposed to the floor that he did not approve of, and he actually rose his hand and said, if we say such and such to the people, it wouldn't be true. And there was a silence all across the Kremlin floor. Then one man began to laugh, and then another one, and they laughed until tears ran down their cheeks. Malcolm Muggeridge said, in that moment, it was truth that had died, not God. But when we lose truth, we end up losing God too in the process. Because in order to know God, you have to have truth, because knowledge is built on things that are true. How do you know something when you don't know something is true or not? As a side note, that's one of my issues I have with some of the emergent church language. We just aren't sure about what truth is anymore. They say out of one side, but on the other side, but we really want to know God. But truth and knowledge are intimately connected. You divorce them and you lose them. The death of truth. We hear statistics about young people today. You know, George Barna says 9% of Christian or non-Christian teenager, either one, 9% affirm that there's such a thing as absolute truth. 9% of American teens, Christian or not, it doesn't matter. They both, the percentage is the same. They affirm that there's such a thing as absolute truth. 9. Those statistics get thrown around a lot, especially by nonprofit apologetics organizations who are fundraising to make more money so they can stave off the problem. What is often not said is what the other part of the statistic is that 8% of young people say that there's no such thing as absolute truth. 9% say there is, 8% says there isn't. There's an 83% gap in the middle of young people that are like, I don't know. I don't know which way to go with this. What am I supposed to do? I really do not believe our young people today are against truth. And I think a lot of the postmodern talk sometimes is hyped up. It comes out of a lot of academia. But on the streets itself, with the young people we talk to on the streets, there is a sense that if they could find the truth, they want it. There's not an attitude that it doesn't exist or it isn't there. Christian Smith, who wrote a wonderful book on teen spirituality, he said that in his interview, he went around the country and just interviewed teenagers. He didn't do the statistical approach. He did more of the conversational approach. He'd sit down with them for an hour, meet them in the library, sit down with them and just talk to them about their life, about their ambitions in life, what they want to do. And he said across the board, he finds that there's just a general therapeutic deism. Yeah, God's there. I'm not sure what he's going to do with my life, but I just need to live life in such a way to sedate myself from all the things I don't like. That's a general teenage attitude. You know, and I remember asking a group of teenagers if they knew what apathy meant, and nobody raised their hand. There was about 150 in the room. And I felt kind of dumb as a speaker, asking to say something and not raising their hand. But I thought that was very revealing. They don't know what apathy is, because they swim in it. I don't care about learning about apathy. Now that's a great oxymoron right there. But I find that Christian Smith's findings, this idea that students, they're optimistic, they want hope for the future, I think they want truth in some way. I think that reveals more where teenagers are at today than what the statistics tell us. I mean, you go to your classroom, go to your Christian classroom and ask them, how many of you believe in absolute truth, and see how many hands are raised? I guarantee you it'll be more than 9%. Partly because they think in a Christian school they need to raise their hand over stuff like that. But in general, I think they will. More than 9% will do it. But there is a confusion about truth nonetheless. We spoke at ACSI conference in November. My wife and I, we were featured speakers. Such an honor to be that. And you know they have those cards they fill out, the people who attend the seminars, and they give their frank opinion. And you read them and you're like, what was this guy even listening? I can't believe this. You know, and you're going through them. One of the ones that came up several times, our theme was questions students are asking. And I was drawing on these questions that we have from teenagers. And I thought that if we just spoke out what the questions were, that the teachers would say, okay, that gives us new insight to where maybe some of our students are at and make us more aware, more attentive to what the questions are, so that we can now be more prepared to give an answer. But one of the common feedback statements we got on the card was, you gave us the questions, now what are the answers? Now, I've never done a teacher conference before November. So I didn't know what teachers were expecting. But I know what I was expecting, and maybe this was naive of me. I was expecting that the teachers would already know those answers. But ask yourself this question. How many of you can define what truth is? Or what's the difference between truth and absolute truth? I mean, if something is true, isn't it true? Why do we have to make it absolutely true? Is that just an emotional word we throw onto it to make it more true than it already is? Could something be more true? Can it be this podium is here, but can we make it more true that the podium is here? We throw these words around in Christianity. We get frightened when our students can't define them or don't understand them. But how often do we understand them ourselves? How often do our teachers understand them so they can speak into the cultural illusion that our students are swimming in? What is truth? Here's a simple definition. This is probably the oldest view of truth from Aristotle onwards, and also the assumption throughout the scripture. Truth is a proposition or an idea or a belief that corresponds with the way things are. Pretty simple. A proposition, an idea, or a belief that corresponds with the way things are. For example, I have in my mind a belief that the podium is behind me. It's right here. That's where the belief is located, right here. The podium is over there. Two separate things, the belief, and there's the podium. But it happens to be the case that the belief that the podium is behind me is actually behind me. This connection between this belief and that podium is what we call truth. An idea, a proposition, a belief that corresponds with the way things really are. That's a definition our young people need to know, especially in this postmodern culture. They need to know it, drill it into their heads. It's a lifesaver. But you know, it's interesting too, that when you bring up the word relativism, how many students gravitate to that word without understanding what it is? The people in our culture gravitate to that word without understanding what it is. In philosophical terms, relativism, or even in the statistical terms, relativism says that there really is no such thing as moral or even what we call metaphysical or actual absolutes. There's no such thing. So we have to invent them. You can't know them. You can't know that this podium's here. That's what relativism does. It's what it is. But what our young people think relativism is the belief that in certain situations, you have to act differently morally. You have to act morally differently in certain situations. I had a teacher sitting on the front row at the conference in Anaheim in November. And I talked about killing. The Bible says, thou shalt not kill. Now, relativists will say, that's just not true. You know, killing or not killing, it's just not true. You just don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But what people think relativism is that in certain situations, things may not be the way they are in other situations. For example, thou shalt not kill. We know you shouldn't go over to your neighbor's house and butcher him. It's just not nice in general. However, if you're found in an act of war and you're not a strong pacifist, you know that in order for justice to prevail, you may need to kill. You may need to lie, too. That's why I don't think Rahab the harlot, well, we don't know if she was a harlot, but that's what we've called her traditionally, so we'll just keep it up. Rahab, in the Old Testament, she lied to the people that were looking for the Israelites that were hidden. They were in wartime. I don't think it was wrong for Rahab to lie there. You can kill and lie in war if you believe a just war theory. But there was a man on the front row who actually fought in Iraq and had to shoot people. And I'm talking to him, I'm talking to the audience saying, there are times when justice needs to be done. It is just not to kill your neighbor, but it may also be just to kill your enemy for the sake of justice. Justice doesn't change, but how it is executed may. Our young people think relativism is how it's executed. If it's executed differently in different situations, therefore it's relativism. And if it's absolute truth, it has to be executed the same way every single time. But the absolute thing is justice. It always has been. People are saying we should leave Iraq and stop fighting there because of justice. Other people say we need to stay and fight in Iraq because of justice. Whether you stay or leave, the big banner of morality that everybody's appealing to is justice. Relativism is not really around very much in the true sense. You can't do politics, can't do courts, can't do law, can't do anything with relativism. You can't even trust the gauge on your gas tank in your car if you're a relativist. You can't trust that when your wife says she's been faithful to you that she really is. You just don't know. Relativism says you just can't know. But then the illusion also comes out in this way when dealing with truth, is that we talk about the word faith. And the word faith we allow the culture to define for us in many times. We allow the culture to define it. How does the culture define faith? You can just Google it on the internet and you can come up with all sorts of different definitions. The prevailing definition is something that you irrationally believe in, even against the evidence. You know, the Skeptics Dictionary and all those are all online. You can see them for yourself. To irrationally believe something even against the evidence. It doesn't matter if there's evidence pro or con. You just believe it. You feel sincere about it. That's what faith has come to mean. I had a woman get up. I was speaking to about a group of 1,000 at a large church in Southern California. And at the Q&A time, a woman came to the microphone and says, you're talking about truth and talking about sharing truth with our young people. But I can't do that because I'm trying to teach my young people about faith. I'm like, wow. She's a very sincere, well-intentioned woman trying to reconcile those two concepts. Here's a question to pose toward that particular dilemma. When God answers your prayers, does your faith grow? Does it become stronger? Or does it become weaker? When God answers your prayers, does it become stronger? Or does it become weaker? If it becomes stronger, then you're saying that faith grows with evidence, because we now have evidence that God is actually listening when God answers our prayers. If it were true that faith grew without evidence, then we would say, God, please do not answer a single prayer that I pray because I want my faith to grow. How goofy is that? That's one of the cultural illusions we have going on in our Christian communities. Faith and truth go very well together. Faith literally means to trust. It's a relational term. You have to trust the chair before you sit in it. You have to trust your friend that he's telling the truth, and you enter into friendship through good faith. And it's the same way with God. He's given us plenty of evidence that he has spoken, that he's of good character. Just read the whole Old Testament. That guy is amazing. We have faith because we trust his character to be consistent. We enter into relationship with him. That's what faith is. And faith is completely dependent on truth. If you get rid of truth, you get rid of biblical faith. Illusion number two. God is a religious idea. God is a religious idea. Michael Newdow, I heard him interviewed by John Ziegler on AM 640 KFI, more stimulating talk radio for those of you Southern California people. It was a very intriguing conversation because Michael Newdow, for those of you who know the name, is the one trying to bring before the Supreme Court the case to get under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance. And he kept saying on the radio program over and over again, we need to remove under God, because Newdow is an atheist, we need to remove under God from the Pledge of Allegiance because God is a religious idea. It says in the First Amendment that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. God is a religious idea. He's a religious idea. We need to remove it from the Declaration of Independence. He needs to be out of there. Congress isn't allowed to do this. I was shouting at my radio. I wanted to call in, but I'm afraid that the day I call in, I'm going to sound like an idiot, so I don't do it. So I bring it before you in a public message, and hopefully it will circulate around the world and around the globe and change everyone's mind. But that's the question. Is God a religious idea? One approach we have to religion in our culture today that is definitely among young people is what I like to term the shopping cart approach. The shopping cart approach. Similar to what Lisa Simpson did in the episode of The Simpsons, in the early career of The Simpsons, when she said, you know, parents, I want to go find the religion that is right for me. And she goes out, she meets Richard Gere in cartoon form, and she becomes a Buddhist. She goes, I really like Buddhism, this is the one that's right for me. And Homer is satisfied with it as long as she celebrates Christmas with the family. I just want to find the religion that is right for me. That is the shopping cart approach that our young people have. When they go to school, especially public school, they're told that God is irrelevant. He doesn't need to come into this discussion. But when they go home and turn on MTV, in 2005 particularly, there was over 21 commercial slots MTV strategically put on their broadcast that represented different religions around the world. Commercials for religions. Because they said they found out that their constituents, their viewers, who are, you know, teenagers and college students, wanted a little bit more religion and spirituality in their lives. So they included 21 different commercials for religions. The shopping cart approach. You just go right along, and the one that's right for you, you just take it off the shelf and you put it in your basket. Oh, Buddhism is good for me today. Well, I think I'll try some Hinduism tomorrow, maybe some Scientology because Tom Cruise is a fun guy. Maybe I'll do Christianity. It's about whether or not it's helpful to you, or if it makes you feel better about yourself. But it may not be about whether it's true or false. You don't do that with shopping carts. You don't say, is this Tabasco sauce true or false? You just choose the Tabasco sauce that works for you, the one that you like. So the question is God a religious idea? Is he a religious idea? Well, the way we determine whether or not he's a religious idea is if we can believe in God without needing religion to do it. And I think all of us in here would agree that you do not need an actual religion or a holy book or even need to go to church to find out that believe in God is a rational thing to do. We have creation all around us. I had to get here somehow. Things don't pop out of nothing. Or as the philosophers say, we have the moral argument, we have the cosmological argument, we have the teleological argument, we have the argument from reason, we have the ontological argument, we have the argument from beauty. All of these put all together is an extremely strong case that God must exist. That's why in philosophy they call him the God of the philosophers. He's the one that you can arrive at, you can believe in, you can discover without opening a single holy book on the planet. God is not a religious idea. You don't need religion to find out he exists. And this is where Michael Newdow is wrong. God isn't a religious idea. He's just a fact that presents himself to us in very interesting and mysterious ways as we go about our lives. I wonder if Michael Newdow would think that we shouldn't feed the poor anymore because a lot of religions believe in that. Yet our government still has a lot of welfare programs to help the poor, of which I'm thankful. Just because a religion believes in something doesn't make it all of a sudden a shopping cart kind of experience. The other side of the shopping cart approach is the experiential approach. And I think it could be best cashed out in a phrase that all of us are familiar with. that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. We use that in our evangelism. We do it to help other people understand or see more clearly what Christianity is about. And I think in the culture that we live in that is so experience-oriented, I think it's a good line and one that we can use. But I think we want to be very careful with it. Because there's a lot of other religions that also say their relationships. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Muslims, Jews, they all believe in a relationship with God. Just using the word relationship doesn't make Christianity unique. And not only does it make it not unique, but it also causes our young people to depend on the experience of feeling close to God in order to be called or considered a Christian. And that is the more damaging part. That is a deep question we get from young people all the time. What do I do when God grows silent? When you read a card that says, "Why did God take my mother?" I asked the same question in 2003 when my own mother died of cancer. And you shout out to the heavens and you wonder if your prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. These kids are struggling with these deep hurts and wounds, saying, "I cried out to God, but I don't feel Him. I was told I would feel Him." Christianity is more than a relationship. It's based on certain historical, non-negotiable facts. And when God grows silent, those are the floorboards of facts I have to stand on. Because my experience will only carry me so far. I only get, fun, ecstatic experience of God maybe once every 10 years, it seems like. Maybe if I were Pentecostal, I might experience that more. Maybe I should look into that. But in all seriousness, when it comes to having a deep and close relationship with God, it isn't about all of the fun, frilly emotions you have on the inside. It's simply about depending on a God who is there. Sometimes you can see Him and sometimes you can't. Depending on the Word that He has presented to us. Sometimes it's difficult to understand. Sometimes it's quite clear. But you have to stand on things that are solid, things that won't change. A lot of our young people will ask on our cards, "What makes you think Christianity is the true religion?" And this is a common question among Christian school kids. What makes you think Christianity is the true religion? Why are you guys so arrogant to think you're so true? In the question itself, what is embedded in the question is the shopping cart. What makes you think that your Tabasco sauce is better than everybody else's Tabasco sauce? They're not thinking in terms of Christianity could be true or false and that you have to put it to the test. They're thinking of it in terms of a shopping cart. Choose the one that works for you. Lisa Simpson was right in a degree. Look for the religion that is right for you. Because true religion is right for everyone. A false religion is right for no one. A true religion is right for everyone. A false religion is right for no one. A true religion is right for everyone. A false religion is right for no one. This is tied a little bit to the crisis of truth. How concerned and how much do we care about truth and the things that remain the same? The New Testament writers care deeply about truth. I love the opening words of John, 1 John. Listen to the language he uses about examining the facts. He's not just talking about some sort of ecstatic experience he had in his own private cave somewhere. He's actually talking about almost scientific sounding language. Listen to this. "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared. We have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you that we have seen and heard, so that you may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make your joy complete." We've seen Him. We've heard Him. Look, this is real stuff. We're not looking for some enlightenment and something that maybe we can have one day if we just ponder our minds long enough. He's actually talking about a real scientifically oriented person who walked, who died, who actually rose from the dead. They saw it. This isn't just fancy Easter celebration material. This is the real thing. And it makes Christianity deeply unique. Let me talk about the third illusion briefly. That Jesus is tame. That Jesus is tame. I get disappointed these days when I see the Christian culture behaving like the consumer culture. When all the grandness of the kingdom and the glory of God and the Godhead as he sits on his throne is reduced to a bumper sticker that says, Jesus loves you. Or, in case of rapture, this car will be unoccupied. I believe those bumper stickers are very well intentioned. But I think it may communicate something. The medium itself may communicate something far beyond what the message intended. It may very well tell people who do not know Jesus that if they become a Christian, they might have to have a tacky bumper sticker. And I know sometimes it's a toe stepper, but sometimes we just need the courage to stand up and say it. Jesus is tame. I was talking to a young person recently, or Philip Yancey said that too often our picture of Jesus is a lot like Mr. Rogers. He's just nice. He'll change his sweater for you and he'll be your neighbor. I have a friend who says niceness is kindness without truth. I was talking to a 20-somethinger recently, and I asked him, I said, how do we help people see that Jesus is less like Mr. Rogers and more like Gandalf the Grey? I wrote a teacher in Northern California, where I spoke back in August, and we've been in touch back and forth, and I shared with her I'd be speaking here, and I said, I'd just love to get your input as a teacher. I said, how do we get students to see Jesus the way Lucy saw Aslan? She said, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? How do we do that? I believe it's partly lodged in the power of our imaginations. Not our imagination to simply create fiction, but our imagination to look into the meaning of things, to see what things really mean. For a long, long time, especially as a teenager, I had this view that Jesus was a two-dimensional flannel graph character passing out fish and loaves. He was hardly dangerous. But I had to get him off of the flannel graph and get him into real life. And I want to share with you just a few things that I did using the imagination to bring Jesus to life. For example, every time I have communion, to this day, every time I have the communion wafer, I hold it in my hand and I think, Jesus is as real as this piece of bread. That's how real he is. Actually, he may be more real than the bread. But he's at least this real. He's not just in my mind. Or how about this? We envision Jesus walking on the Sea of Galilee, but maybe we need to walk over to our neighborhood pond and envision him walking across that. Galilee was just the disciples' pond. That's how near and real Jesus is. What about inviting Jesus into our hobbies? Like I had a student ask me, he was 17, he says, how do I know God is real? And I said, well, he's like, I don't know how to make Jesus real in my life. I said, well, what is real to you? He's like, well, basketball. Invite Jesus into basketball. Look at your basketball, the lines and the texture on it. Jesus is as real as your basketball. Ah, okay. He's not just over in my shopping cart. He's as real as my basketball. He's as real as a computer. You write your schedules out on every day. Paul Ford, he wrote the book, The Companion to Narnia. He said Narnia was a real help for him, especially when he went through a serious dryness in his life. He said his mentor died, and after his mentor died, it brought in him such turmoil that he had a hard time even praying to God. And all he could think of was Shasta in The Horse and His Boy, where Shasta was supposed to meet the rest of his group on the other side of Tashbane. But he got there late at night and all the city gates were closed and his friends didn't show up. And he's out there by the tombs. He's sitting by the tombs facing the desert. He hears hyenas approaching from the desert and he's terribly frightened. Then he hears the roar of a giant lion and he's terribly frightened of lions, even more than hyenas. But when the lion roars, the hyenas, their voices trail off and they disappear. Then out from behind the tombs, a small house cat walks up to Shasta, curls up, and lays down at his back. Paul Ford said, "Even though I felt like God was so distant and far away from me, and even though the tombs were behind me with the death of my mentor, and uncertainty was before me with the desert, I knew that I could still pray because Aslan sleeps at my back." The power of the imagination sometimes can breathe new life into a word and into a person that we find tame and tasteless. And that is something our young people need to see. Need to envision. Who is this Jesus? Could he possibly be like Gandalf the Grey, through whose hair flows all the winds of wisdom? And he's from a place that no imagination could possibly comprehend. So what are some practical things? Teachers, administrators, they like practical things. So let me throw out some practical ideas. Breaking the illusions. These are just some things that came to mind. But I think that as you explore and as you think, you'll be able to come up even with some more ideas. First of all, we need to know we have some illusions and be on the alert, be on the watch for them. That has to start with us. We can only offer to our teachers, to our young people, what begins with us. Not what we pretend is in us, but what is really in us. Secondly, give your teachers time and the incentive to attend something like, if you're in Southern California, for example, a Biola Apologetics series. Or look for retreats to send them off on, even for a weekend, to do some sort of spiritual formation retreat. But thinking about what are the false beliefs that are lodged in their souls so they become the kind of people that can affect the children, the students. Or maybe have them assign a book a year that deals with youth culture. And there's quite a few out there that deal with youth culture itself, just to keep them aware. Only teachers who are culturally aware can produce students that are culturally aware. And one long-term strategy is maybe hire teachers who have a desire to break the illusions of the culture. Maybe part of the interview process is by figuring out how culturally savvy some of your teachers are. Some teachers may not get the highest grades, but they may be extremely intuitive about what's going on in the culture. And those are the ones that end up changing a lot of lives. And the one that I think is the most interesting is this. Teach kids to unplug. You heard about it this morning, about unplugging. Pretend that your family goes back to the 1850s. It's such a simple thing. My sister-in-law goes to a public school in Whittier. She says it's hard to talk to people because they all have iPods in their ears during break time. I don't know what the rules are at your school, but that may be something to consider about unplugging the students from these devices while they're at school. They've stepped into a Christian culture. In a Christian culture, we don't need these kind of diversions. We need to face our issues head on. How about assigning things in our classes, like in our Bible class, to say, we're going to do a spiritual exercise. The spiritual exercise is tonight, I want you to go home, let not listen to any music, no TV, no computer. And I want you to journal about how you feel about that and bring it back tomorrow. And then maybe halfway through the school year, say, now your assignment for this weekend is to do all that for the entire weekend. And maybe by the end of the year, for the big final exam, is you can do it for a week. And asking them poignant questions as they do it. How did you feel about this? Why did you feel like you needed it? What did you do in your spare time? Some of those spiritual disciplines, I think, will go a long way with these young people. So back to Eustace and Prince Rillian and Puddleglum the Marshwiggle. There they are, facing the witch, and the enchantment is upon them. And they don't realize the enchantment is upon them. It's just about taking its full effect. And then something happens. Puddleglum, the Marshwiggle. He just pulls all of his resources together, and he walks over, and he steps on the fire, for his feet were webbed, and he didn't think he would feel it, and he was a little bit wrong, but he stepped on the fire. Suddenly several things happened. First of all, the witch shouted out, "Oh, get away from that before I kill you!" You know, and that kind of voice made all the children like, "Whoa, there's some strange non, you know, thrumming lady screaming at us in here." The second thing that happened was the smell of burnt marshwiggle is very unenchanting. Of course, that cleared their senses a little bit. And for Puddleglum himself, there's nothing that clears up a good enchantment than a sharp bit of pain. And he turned, and this is what he said. "I have one word, ma'am," he said, coming back to the fire, limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been giving, all you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. Now, I'm a chap who always likes to know the worst and then put the best face on it I can. So I won't deny any of what you said, but there's one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things. Trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we are. Well, then all I could say is, in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. I suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as a Narnian, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thank you kindly for supper. These two gentlemen and the young lady are ready. We're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for Narnia. Not that our lives would be very long, I should think. But that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say." The consumer culture, the consumer cult, is a very dull place to be. To be confused about truth is dull, especially when you have Jesus who says, "I am the truth." To have a shopping cart view of religion is dull, especially when you have someone like John saying, "You won't believe what we saw with our eyes, what we heard with our ears, the Lord of glory has been among us." And a very tame Jesus is dull, especially when you have a Gandalf-like character who's ready to ride in, holding forth the flame of heaven to cast any Balrog into the dark pit of the earth. We have our own imaginations given us by God, our own reasons, our own ability to navigate the truth in this world. And may all of those be stirred as you work toward breaking the enchantments in your Christian schools. Bless you. Thank you for listening so well.